You are listening to Consider This on KZYX. My name is Stuart Campbell, and I welcome you to the program. We're on the web at considerthis.us, where you can sign up to receive email updates about future programs. We're also on the KZYX website, and you can get information about future, current, and past programs, and listen to or download podcasts of past shows at both locations. You can call us here in the studio a little later on the program at 707-895-2448, or you can send your comments or questions at any time to dj@kzyx.org. My guest on this program is Lisa Tessman, professor of philosophy at Binghamton University. She teaches and does research in ethics, moral psychology, feminist philosophy, and related areas. Her work focuses on understanding how real human beings construct morality and experience moral demands, especially under difficult conditions. She takes an experiential, empirical approach to ethics, which includes psychology and neuroscience, rather than exclusively relying on what has sometimes been called kind of an armchair philosophical and abstract theoretical approach. She is the author of Moral Failure, On the Impossible Demands of Morality, and most recently, When Doing the Right Thing is Impossible, in which she provides examples of situations that will make us wonder whether we can be required to do the impossible, and how and why human beings have constructed moral requirements to be binding even when they are impossible to fulfill. Professor Tessman, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. So your interest here is in the sometimes impossible demands of morality in people's lived experience. You draw on the Western philosophical tradition that includes, among others, Kantian ethics and utilitarianism, which for the most part attempt to provide kind of a theoretical framework for reasoning about ethical issues so that people can come to make moral judgments about what to do. And while that's certainly an important part of ethics, certainly the part that I was trained in most deeply, I don't want to draw too sharp a dichotomy here, but you also bring in a more intuitive and emotional approach as being necessary to understanding and thinking about how human beings actually construct our moral views and employ ethical thinking in day-to-day living. I don't want to assume that those listening to us today are familiar with that background, so I would appreciate it if you could start off by making some general comments to introduce the topic of ethics as a philosophical discipline, and then if you could situate your approach against that background.
Sure. So the idea that one cannot be required to do the impossible comes from one of the traditions that you mentioned, which is the Kantian ethical tradition. The phrase that gets used to explain that is ought implies can. In other words, if there's something that you ought to do, it must be true that it's something you can do. And that's the claim that I'm arguing against in this book. And both the Kantian tradition and the utilitarian tradition would abide by that principle that ought implies can. And the reason that I depart from them is because I think that in our more automatic, intuitive judgments, we often make a judgment that we are required to do something even when it's impossible. So the question is what status those kinds of intuitive judgments should have and whether we should ever have confidence in those judgments rather than in the reasoned conclusion that we cannot be required to do the impossible.
So you start off in the introduction by talking about a situation during Hurricane Katrina to really illustrate these kinds of impossible moral demands. Why don't we just start right there and get into some of these actual cases where people do face what seem to be really impossible situations?
Yes, great. So the example, I mean, I fictionalize it in the book, but and there's some controversy about what really did happen in the situation. But basically, many hospitals were flooded during Hurricane Katrina. And in one hospital, Memorial Hospital, the flooding was very bad, and people were trapped inside the hospital for 5 days while the evacuation was taking place extremely slowly. And a situation arose where there were patients who, on the one hand, the evacuation wasn't happening quickly enough and they couldn't be moved, and they were not going to be able to be moved. On the final day of the evacuation, not everybody was going to be able to get out, either because they were in a condition where they couldn't be moved, or either because the move itself probably would have killed them, or they were simply too heavy to move, and so on. So the doctors and nurses faced a decision. They themselves had been ordered to leave the hospital, and they could either abandon those patients that they couldn't move, in which case they would surely die, but die a slow and painful death, or they could administer drugs that would make them die quickly and painlessly. Is sometimes called mercy killings. The patients weren't in a condition that they could give consent. So their choice, their dilemma, was between two things, each of which are morally forbidden. One, for a doctor, is to abandon your patients, and the other is to kill them without consent, and they had that decision to make. Now, what really happened, as I said, is unclear, but it looks likely that some doses of medication were administered, and that was the decision that at least some of the doctors and nurses made. So my point about the example is not that they made the right decision or made the wrong decision, but that either decision that they had made, they would have inevitably committed some wrongdoing simply because there was no morally clean or innocent option that was available to them.
So this gets into a key distinction, I think, for you, and it's in the second chapter, and we can jump right to it, is this idea of whether or not there are moral dilemmas and how you analyze what a moral dilemma is, and you do that by distinguishing moral conflicts and moral dilemmas. So if you would start to elucidate that distinction.
Sure. So, I mean, everyone can agree that that was a moral conflict. They had two things that, had they not conflicted with each other, it would have been clear what to do, right? In normal circumstances, it's clearly wrong to abandon the patient. In normal circumstances, it's clearly wrong to administer drugs to kill them. So these two requirements conflicted with each other. We'll call it a dilemma when the conflict itself doesn't somehow resolve the question fully and leave one with just one right thing to do. So, for instance, you mentioned at the beginning of the utilitarian tradition, a utilitarian would be focused on what the best outcome of the situation could be. How can we maximize the overall good in the resulting state of affairs from whatever decision that we make? And we'd do a kind of a cost-benefit analysis to see which decision would result in the better consequences. So suppose we did that cost-benefit analysis and we decided that it was overall better to engage in mercy killing in this case. A utilitarian would then say, okay, the conflict has been fully resolved. You did the right thing by virtue of doing the best thing that was possible. And my claim is that in some situations of conflict, indeed, it can be completely resolved by choosing the best thing to do. But that's only the case if the value that gets sacrificed is a value that I call negotiable. Namely, whatever choice you do make, that good outcome can somehow fully substitute for or compensate for the value that does get sacrificed. And I don't think that that's always the case. So some values are uniquely valuable and irreplaceable, and a human life would be an example of that. So any moral conflict in which one has to make a decision in which a human life is going to be sacrificed, you're sacrificing something that can't be replaced, that can't be compensated for by the value of whatever you've done instead. And that makes that value non-negotiable, and it makes it wrong to sacrifice that value, even if doing so was the best possible thing that you could do.
So there's some debate about whether or not such moral dilemmas actually exist. You've mentioned that for somebody who's coming from a consequentialist perspective, they don't. So why don't we fill that out a little bit more and talk about the different approaches a bit more, and why some people think at one level there aren't even conflicts in a sense, but certainly it's perhaps more debatable whether or not there are real moral dilemmas.
Right. So, yeah, you mentioned the consequentialist. I mean, I use the term utilitarian, which is a version of consequentialism.
Right.
Yeah, that's the same tradition. The Kantian tradition will is probably a less common one for people to take, because you actually have to deny that there can be conflicts between true moral requirements or duties. And that's because any duty there is absolute. And so in the Kantian tradition, they also would say that there are no moral dilemmas, but they would reach that conclusion in a different way. They would simply employ the idea that ought implies can, that you can't be obligated to do something impossible, and then point out that if there's each of two things that you're required to do, then you're required to do both of them. So you're required to do both, but you can't do both, and you can't be required to do something impossible, and that's a contradiction. And having reached a contradiction, they have to reject one of the premises that they started with, and they'll reject the claim that there was a moral conflict between two absolute duties to begin with. So it's simply by this kind of logical reasoning that they end up with the conclusion that it would be contradictory to say that there is a moral dilemma. Therefore, there can't be any moral dilemmas.
Let me just interject for a second. So
sure.
Then what would their response have to be to the real lived experience that people have of having moral dilemmas, being faced by these conflicts?
Well, they would say that it's an apparent conflict, but if we figure out what the true duties are, we might see that there are some conflicting grounds for there being a conflict, but there can't actually be a conflict of duties. One of those duties must not really have been my duty.
Okay.
You kind of back them into a corner that way, because then it's difficult to say, well, what was my duty then that didn't run into any kind of a conflict. So my main claim against actually both of the traditions is that although it's true that we can reason our way to the conclusion that there are no genuine moral dilemmas, the problem with that conclusion is that it doesn't ring true to our experience, because our judgments about whether or not there are moral dilemmas tend to be made not through this conscious reasoning process, but rather through a more intuitive, automatic process, which does tend to be influenced by our emotions. And we can easily, in that way, judge ourselves to be impossibly required. So instead of arguing on a rational basis against either the utilitarians or the Kantians to say that they've made a mistake in their reasoning, say, I instead claim that reasoning is not the only thing that can give authority to our moral judgments, that some of our moral judgments we should have confidence in, even if they aren't the conclusions we would reach through a strict reasoning process.
Yeah, that really struck me, and I really liked the way that you developed that. In my training in graduate school, this was called a non-cognitive,
right.
I can't even get the word out,
yeah.
Approach. And, you know, that it was in my teaching, in my studying in grad school, it was pretty much roundly criticized. And I'd like you to develop that new, it's fairly recent, I think, particularly this more intuitive, affective-based, very quick, automatic, even unconscious kind of approach to thinking about ethics, which has grown out of work in psychology and neuroscience that really starts to back it up. And I think kind of forces us in philosophy to reconsider some of these more long-standing traditional approaches.
Right. So I'll begin by saying that I think that morality itself is something that is constructed. And it's constructed out of what we human beings actually do value, what kind of actual judgments we make about what's morally right and wrong, as opposed to there being some kind of moral facts independent of any of our attitudes, our evaluative attitudes towards anything. And so the question is, how are values constructed? And that's why I turn to all of this empirical study of how moral judgments are actually made, because I think we have to look at how we actually make our moral judgments if we think that morality itself is constructed out of the judgments, the evaluative judgments that we actually make. Now, what this doesn't mean is that every single judgment we make is correct, right? I still want to be able to say that we can go wrong when we judge ourselves to be required to do something. We might even look back at judgments we made earlier in our lives and say, oh, I was so wrong then. You know, I can now take a critical view of that and change my mind. And we certainly do that about each other's judgments. We disagree with each other. So it's not that everything we judge, particularly every emotion we feel, leads us to the right judgment or to a judgment that we should put any authority in. So we need some kind of critical process for deciding which values, which moral requirements really count. But that process need not be only a reasoning process. So let me talk a little bit about the empirical work. One of the most important, I think, empirical discoveries about moral judgment is that most of our moral judgments are made intuitively rather than through reasoning. And when I talk about intuitive rather than reasoned judgments, I'm referring to what psychologists sometimes call a dual process theory of cognition, including moral cognition. And that's that we have different processes that we can use to make judgments. And some of those processes are conscious, and we can go through steps of reasoning, draw inferences, or make calculations, all of which is conscious. But we also have another process that we are not aware of because it takes place below the level of consciousness. And we actually get through, you know, most of our daily lives on that level, doing things automatically without having to be conscious about having made a decision about it. And it turns out that many of our moral judgments are made in this unconscious way through automatic associations. And so we might, for instance, driven by an emotion such as empathy or fear or guilt, any of these kinds of emotions can lead us to make a fast automatic judgment that something matters, that something is required, that something is forbidden. And that's how our judgments about impossible moral requirements come about. We may take something that in ordinary circumstances we agree we are required to do, like, for instance, the doctor is required to not abandon the patients and to not kill the patients. And then in a situation where that action has become impossible, we still go on making the same automatic judgment. We aren't going through the reasoning process that says, well, but ought implies can, so it can't be the case that I'm required to not kill the patients, it must be permissible, and so on. Instead, we're still making an automatic association to, no, killing patients is forbidden. You know, I mustn't do it. So we see how we can arrive at that judgment that we're impossibly required. We can arrive at it automatically. And then the question is, should I trust that automatic judgment, or should I dismiss it precisely because it wasn't made through reasoning? And my claim is that what we need from each other as human beings, and that's really what morality is about regulating what we need from each other in order that we can live cooperatively together. What we really need from each other is not just reasoned responses. For instance, we need other people to love us, to care about us, and to respond empathically to us. And so sometimes what we want from another person is not that they have reasoned that what they're going to do to us is justified, but rather we want that immediate, automatic, say, empathic response, or a response driven by a variety of other emotions.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This on KZYX. I'm your host, Stuart Campbell, and my guest is philosopher Lisa Tessman, author of When Doing the Right Thing is Impossible. You can find out more on the web at considerthis.us or the kzyx.org website. I'd like to tie this a little bit more and come back to this idea of constructing morality, because that's also been a part of the tradition that's, it hasn't been thought to be constructed, and I think there's research in psychology and neuroscience, but also in anthropology that really does indicate that different cultural groups, different communities do construct morality. I had an anthropologist on who was giving us a natural history of ethics and really tried to clearly make that point. And I think he agreed with you that morality is fundamentally about how communities get along, how they cooperate, how they work with one another. The fear, I think, among philosophers, and there's this constant pressure, I think, to push back against what that seems to lead to as some kind of relativism. You already made the point that it doesn't mean that these intuitive judgments are going to be correct, but it also doesn't open the door to just any old moral judgment. Could you talk about that a little bit?
Sure. And actually, I think I don't really talk about this much in the book.
Right.
I'll think about it now. There is a philosopher named David Wong who has put out a version of relativism that I find extremely plausible. It's sometimes referred to as a moderate version of relativism. And his claim is that there are some very broad universal constraints on morality. And that's because there is such a thing as a human nature that constrains us, and because there are some constraints given by the fact that we're all trying to solve a similar problem, namely how, given human nature, we can live cooperatively together. And since our human nature includes both egoistic and altruistic motivations, we need to balance those. We need to balance kind of self-interested and other regarding concerns in order to live cooperatively together. So any adequate morality is going to have to find some way of regulating our self-regarding and other regarding interests to make that kind of cooperation possible. So there are constraints. There are things that would fall outside of that and that cannot serve as an adequate morality or an adequate set of values with some priority ordering to that values. But within those very broad constraints, there is not just one single uniquely right morality. There are multiple ways that we can order our lives together that could be successful in enabling cooperation and beneficial cooperation. So he, like myself, is a moral value pluralist, and believe that there are a number of different things that human beings value and that we give this kind of the authority of morality to. And most cultures will have a great deal of overlap in identifying what these values are. But where they will tend to differ is when these values conflict, which one do we give priority to? So, for example, this is his example, a culture might value autonomy rather than community when they conflict. It might prioritize autonomy or vice versa. And it's the fact that these values are not necessarily commensurable or comparable to each other in terms of a single measuring metric, so that there is no neutral place from which to judge that one takes priority over the other. They're different from each other, and we value them differently. So as a result, there are multiple kind of valid ways of constructing moralities, and different cultures will come up with different versions. That doesn't mean anything goes, because a morality or a set of values or a way of prioritizing them could certainly fall outside of the universal constraints. But it does mean that there are going to be multiple possible ways of doing it.
Well, let's get back to this distinction between the reasoned and the intuitive. And so if I just follow up on this distinction you just drew between valuing autonomy versus community, the research suggests that valuing of either one of those is very much, would you say it's fair to say unconscious, and the judgments we make from those values are intuitive and fast and not reasoned?
Yeah, that's a really good question. There is some empirical work showing that different kinds of moral judgments, some tend to be made more through reasoning and some more automatically and intuitively. So, but the ones that we tend to be motivated to act on are those that we make intuitively. So a psychologist named Daniel Batson has research showing that when nobody is watching, people tend not to abide by the impartial moral principles that they claim to be committed to, like fairness. So there is some interesting work on the question of whether all moral judgments are made in the same way and whether they're all equally motivated. But the general point, I'm not trying to argue for intuition rather than reasoning.
Right.
I'm arguing for a pluralist position that we make different judgments in different ways, and there's value to the different ways in which we make it. So, for instance, we tend to be to exercise impartial judgment more through our reasoning. When we feel empathy or love or other emotions like that towards somebody, we tend to act partially toward them and override impartial moral judgments. So a reasoned judgment that we ought to act fairly, say, and a more intuitive judgment that we should be maybe loyal to a friend could conflict with each other. And I'm not arguing for one over the other. What I'm saying is that those are both valuable. And when they conflict, they might create a dilemma. They might create a situation where no matter what you do, you're going to be sacrificing some value that really is important.
Let's explore that a little bit further. So you talk about love. You've talked about that today, love already. In the book, you also talk about sacred values. And I found it very interesting, the idea that there really is a requirement that those kinds of relationships sometimes impose on us to react intuitively, to make the moral judgment quickly, and that to even be seen to reason about it can itself be thought to be immoral.
Right. So the most famous example is one given by Bernard Williams in an article where he talks about a boat where some people have fallen overboard, and there's, you know, the rescuer is standing on the boat, and one of the people who has fallen overboard is his wife, who he presumably loves, and the others are strangers. And the idea is that the wife would want him to automatically prioritize rescuing her, rescue her first, rather than that he stand there and reason and say, you know, can I come up with a justification that says that it's permissible to rescue my wife first? And maybe he does come up with a justification and says, okay, good, it's justified, now I can rescue her first. So he says, to do that would be to think one thought too many, and that the wife would have wanted that he do it automatically out of love rather than out of the thought that it was justified. So I'm applying that same idea more widely, that there are things that we want from each other, and it's not just that we want, say, to be rescued, but we want it to be done out of a certain motivation, depending on what our relationship is with the person. So in personal relationships, we don't just want a reasoned justification for the action. We want someone to be motivated by certain emotions to respond to us. And to find, I use the term unthinkable, to find certain actions towards us to be not just wrong, but to be unthinkable in a very literal sense in which we shouldn't consider it an option that we will weigh against other options. We shouldn't reason about it in the sense of calculating or finding justification for whether or not we should do it, but rather we should do it without having to go through that process of finding justification, that thought or reasoning process.
I have to say I find that both intuitive and reasonable to think that way. Could you expand, and I mentioned it, that it's not just love relationships, but it's in cases where we sacralize some values,
right,
either religiously or politically or even just culturally.
Right. So there's work by Philip Tetlock on sacred values, and he does experiments where he kind of tells a narrative about a character who makes a decision and then finds out whether his subjects are outraged at that character. And it turns out they express outrage if the character makes the decision in a certain way. So, for instance, there's one character who's a hospital administrator, and he has to decide whether to use funds to save Johnny's life, Johnny is a little boy, or use those same funds for other hospital needs. And the subjects find that if the character is said to have deliberated about it for a long time and then decide to save Johnny, then they express outrage at him. Whereas if he automatically decides, oh, we're going to save Johnny, they don't feel outrage. So what they've done is they have sacralized the value of Johnny's life because he's a distinct named individual. So we treat certain values, psychologically we treat certain values as sacred, which means simply that it would be unthinkable not to protect those values. So, you know, the example I gave was when you love somebody, it should be unthinkable to, say, not protect them. But I do think it extends in cases beyond personal love relationships, and that we often expect others to respond to particular individuals in ways that show that it would be unthinkable for them to not protect another person's life, say. But, I mean, sacralizing is very problematic because we tend to treat the value of somebody's life as sacred when they're a distinct, identifiable individual, whether or not, you know, we knew them a moment before. But we don't tend to sacralize lives when they are very distant, either geographically or socially distant from us, or when they're presented as a very large statistic. So, you know, we may know thousands of people are dying across the globe, and we don't feel compelled in the same way to respond to them as we do when there's a single individual up close to us. And that's problematic. So it's not just that we should always act on our sacred values, but it's another situation where we both judge it to be wrong not to protect a sacred value, but also, if we think about it, it's wrong not to protect those thousands of distant lives that may be in danger and that we're not actually acting to protect. And so, you know, there are also, again, many classic dilemmas of, do I sacrifice the one person to save the many? And those are genuine dilemmas. They're not conflicts that can be resolved in such a way that when you give the better answer, you're then guaranteed that you're doing the right thing.
Another way that sacralizing values can, they can go horribly wrong. I mean, that's making a moral judgment, but it would seem to be that people can intuitively incorporate some of these sacred values that then they employ that really produce, particularly from a second-order look, maybe a Kantian look or a utilitarian look, really aren't the proper decision to make, so they can go pretty wrong.
Absolutely. I mean, we see sacred values in religious contexts, in other political contexts, in kind of very strong ideologies where people end up committing murders, genocides even, in the name of something that is sacred. So they can absolutely go wrong. And so, you know, the difficulty is both that we seem to need from each other that we be treated as a sacred value ourselves sometimes, and yet we should be very, very wary of what we do in the name of sacred values. So they need to be scrutinized critically, but that critical scrutiny is exactly what's forbidden if the idea is that we should think of certain actions as unthinkable. And that I don't have a solution to.
Right.
Simply, you know, that's what I'm trying to do in this book is not really give, certainly not give action guiding solutions, but rather to say this is why morality is so difficult for human beings.
Right. It is messy.
Yes.
But this idea of love relationships and sacralizing values does give us a way into seeing how things could appear to people, show up for people, they could experience them as real dilemmas. If you've got a love relationship which requires you to act intuitively on some basis or some issue, and then you've got maybe a different, maybe even sacred value more for the community or your group or an organization, then those can be in deep conflict, and going one way or the other doesn't get rid of the other, doesn't eliminate it.
Exactly. Yep. I mean, I would say that's the main point I want to make, is that because there are plural values that can't substitute for each other and those values can conflict, we can very well be caught in situations where no matter what we do, we're sacrificing one of these values that really do matter. And that you can use the term tragic to describe it. But I think that's the situation we're in. I tend to use the term of unavoidable failure more than the term tragedy, but a lot of tragic literature is getting at that same idea.
So I'm going to open up the phone lines here for listener call-ins in just a few minutes, and people can call in at 707-895-2448. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Consider This on KZYX. I'm your host, Stuart Campbell. My guest is philosopher Lisa Tessman. She's author of When Doing the Right Thing is Impossible. You can find out more on the show's website at considerthis.us or the KZYX www.thebiblecenter.org website. I'm just reminded of myself back in grad school. I had a teacher who was teaching ethics, and he was using the word intuition. He was somewhat of an intuitionist, I guess. But my problem at the time, and I think I've evolved since then, but my problem at the time was, well, your intuition may not be my intuition, and so there can be, and how do you resolve that? How do we determine whether our intuitions are the right intuitions? One, we can make reasoned judgments. So I'd like you to talk about maybe some of those cases where it is important to look, and then maybe there just is this impossible dilemma where we're supposed to not even think about it, and those can't be resolved exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I find there's interesting work on how we actually do change our intuitions by Jonathan Haidt, who's written a lot of popular books. And the idea is that we tend to be pretty bad at scrutinizing our own intuitions because we are biased towards them, and we use our reasoning to come up with justifications for keeping our intuitions. But we tend to be better at criticizing each other's intuitions. So the likeliest way that we are to change our intuitions is by somebody else confronting us. And they don't even necessarily have to present us with an argument. It may be that if we are a member of a group that they're a part of and we want to belong to that group and we want to be cohesive in that group, there's some pressure to change our intuitions so that we share them with the others that we're with. But it may also be that other people can spark a new intuition in us. So the whole idea of put yourself in somebody else's shoes. Once you put yourself in someone else's shoes, if you can really vividly imagine a situation different from yours, you may have a different intuition just from that different imagined perspective. So there are ways that we can socially influence each other to change our intuitions. And that seems to be how our intuitions are most likely to change. But you're right that what there isn't is some kind of recourse to the facts, right? To some objective, independently existing moral facts that could simply determine, if you and I disagree in our intuitive judgments, which one of us is right. And some of those disagreements may be because, although we share our general values, we're prioritizing different values in a certain case. And we may then, you know, continue to disagree about that. And I'm not so concerned about the disagreement being irresolvable, but you know, often for the sake of living together, we need to reach some kind of agreement, and often that's done politically, if not just more generally socially through social norms.
We do have a call coming in, so I'm going to go ahead and take that first call.
Okay.
Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please? And if your radio's still on, please turn it off.
Idealist.
Idealists, what about that?
That's my name.
Oh, okay, go ahead.
Hi. I see two things. First, Buddhism, and second, it's the Constitution. The Constitution protects our human rights. These are rights that we have, that we're born with. And if there is any discussion, we have courts to protect those human rights. And then we have Buddhism. Buddhism does an excellent job of helping us, guiding us, telling us that, for example, we have right speech, right action. It shows people how to proceed for the benefit of the other. And so,
good points.
I could speak better, but I'm not very good at it.
Well, let's get Lisa to respond. I think they're two good points. Thanks.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think really comment much on the part about Buddhism because I don't know enough about Buddhist ethics to say anything much about it. But in terms of what human rights we have turned into into laws or into legal policies, whether in the Constitution or other ways of legalizing things. I mean, I think that the construction of morality leads, in some cases, to social norms, which are enforced informally, and leads, in some cases, to laws, which are enforced formally and with a different kind of apparatus. So there's nothing incompatible about pointing to laws that protect our rights and to say that morality is constructed, because, of course, those laws have also been constructed by us. We have just taken a different route to formalize them and to enforce them in our society.
Well, we have also, I think, sacralized rights, at least some of them, right?
Yes. I mean, different societies sacralize different things, but I would definitely say that in, say, Western societies that have incorporated human rights into their laws, those rights do tend to be sacralized in the minds of many people.
Again, if you have a question for Professor Lisa Tessman about ethics and morality, please give us a call at 707-895-2448. We haven't really gone in the direction quite yet. Maybe we've touched on it peripherally, but while people can certainly experience moral dilemmas, I think we've made that fairly clear, the question still remains whether or not people really have those kinds of obligations. Maybe we'll get back to that question. I've got the lines lighting up now, so I think I'm going to go ahead and go back to the calls. Hi there. You're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Hi, David.
David, go ahead.
How does or does what you're talking about apply to autonomous driving cars and how a car might have to decide if it hits a group of people or an individual with a pushing a stroller? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
All right, David, thanks.
Thank you. That's a fantastic question. It's a really difficult one. I don't think I have a great answer to it. So the question is about if you have driverless vehicles, the driverless vehicle has to be programmed so that it will be able to make a decision if it has the choice of, say, hitting, if your example was one person pushing a stroller versus a group of people in the other direction. Philosophers have constructed a lot of dilemmas kind of similar to this. Sometimes they're called the trolley dilemmas,
right,
where, for instance, should you divert a runaway trolley that's on a track that's going to hit five people? Should you divert it onto a sidetrack so it will hit only one person? It raises the issue of if you're the agent making that decision to divert it, you're actively killing the one person, whereas the five people, you would just be letting them die rather than actively killing them. But five lives is more valuable than one. So the question with driverless cars is exactly this kind of dilemma. There's a lot of arguments on both sides about what is the right thing to do. Our intuitions tend to tell us that we can't actively kill, and yet we have less strong intuitive judgments about letting something or someone else kill and not intervening. But our reasoned decision is usually to preserve the larger number of lives rather than the smaller number. So I think that since when we're programming the driverless vehicle, we're doing it at a distance where we tend to engage more in impartial reasoning. At that distance, if I were programming the vehicle, I would certainly program it to choose to hit a smaller group of people rather than a larger group of people. The problem is that now, if I'm going to get into that driverless car, instead of driving it myself, I am now not in a position to make the decision I might make intuitively if I were actually driving it, right? Particularly if, say, the one person that I would hit is somebody that I know and am attached to, and the group of people are strangers. So what we're doing is we're shifting the moral decision-making to an agent that is neutral, the driverless car, instead of to the driver who might make an intuitive judgment. And I don't know whether people would be willing to get into driverless cars that would make different decisions than they themselves would make as drivers if they were in the car. So that's a hard question. I mean, the main thing I want to say about it is drivers can encounter dilemmas because we're in charge of a large, heavy thing that can kill people, and whenever that's the situation, we can be confronted with a dilemma where we have to make life and death decisions.
And it's interesting, too, you say program the driverless vehicle. That really is a reasoned, it's using approach, it's using an algorithm, it's not intuitive, unless some of the AI people are right and we're going to get embodied machines that can make more intuitive judgments. Seems unlikely to me personally, but it seems to me that does highlight that dilemma.
Right.
Okay, I've got go ahead.
I was just going to say that's a really interesting question that I think has come up a lot in engineering ethics recently.
Yeah, yeah. Got another call. Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Oh, yes.
You got to turn your radio down.
Yes, I did. I just did. This is Randy from Willits, and I'm really greatly appreciating the discussion this morning. It's good to have some depth, you know. It's a miracle. I think KZYX is a really critical, important tool for education and for our hearts to be able to know that we're not the only intellectuals around trying to figure things out.
Thanks, Randy.
Yeah, and I've always thought, I've got two thoughts that I'd like to get her comment on. I've always said that there's a conflict of values taking place on the planet, and one is life and one is death. You know, it's like and the Buddhist concept is that life is death and death is life. It's all renewal. We're borrowing this planet for our children. And, you know, it's not ours. We come in naked, we leave naked. So we're stewards, we're caretakers and caregivers. And so life and death is part of it, the conflict of values. And ahimsa, do you know the term ahimsa?
No, I don't.
It's a Buddhist term, and it means do no harm.
Okay.
Do no harm. And Ra is rational adult to me. How would a rational adult behave? Well, rational adult behavior is based on both the conscious and the unconscious, what you were talking about, intuitive. And that you can get into what I call too much thinking. Sometimes we go by the gut. We have to, you know, we do have this instinctual understanding, you know, what we don't always have to think about it. We just do the right thing. You step up, you save that child from walking across the road. But I'd like to get it into specifics, both war. I want to know, you know, if I'm a pacifist, I'm nonviolent. There are core values that I hold dear. Children are sacred. You know, life is sacred. We are here. We're working out. This is part of our karma. Dharma is where we're like salamanders coming out of the ocean. You know, in terms of our evolution, we are still growing. We are still learning. We're not where we're supposed to be yet.
Randy, can you wrap it up and then we'll
have
Lisa respond.
Okay, so the war, I wanted to ask about abortion. That's another one.
War and abortion, okay.
But one is abortion because you can have five children and a new one comes and what am I going to do if I have another one if it's going to break me down? But also life is sacred. And the two children in China, you know, there are many, many ways of the practical application of the knowledge is where I want to, and environment. Let me get this down to about the like the scenic corridor. If in the destruction of the planet, if war creates, I call it mad, mutual assured destruction. If they drop a nuclear bomb and it's going to destroy the atmosphere, if it, you know, takes the ozone out and we have no more oxygen, if it, we continue to pollute.
Randy,
environment and abortion and war.
Okay,
were the three that I was thinking. How do you practically apply? Anyhow, thank you.
Thanks, Randy.
Okay, thank you for the question. I mean, I think those are all three potentially places where dilemmas can arise. And again, I want to reiterate that my main point is not in any dilemma going to be to tell you how to solve that dilemma and what the right thing to do is, but rather I see my role more as to point out that something is a dilemma, whereas others are often saying what the right or wrong thing to do is. So, for instance, in the case of war, I can't take a completely pacifist position because I think that usually there are good reasons both to engage and to not engage. I mean, obviously, it depends on what the military action is, but the problem with doing no harm is that sometimes it's not possible to do no harm. So you're choosing between harms, and they're often harms of very different sorts. So it's impossible to generalize about war, but in many cases, it's going to be a question of killing some to save others or to achieve other aims that are also valuable. So often taking, you know, a single position, like a pacifist position down the line, ignores the values that might be gained by engaging in, say, a military action. With abortion, you know, there is no dilemma if you don't see the fetus already as a life. But if you see the fetus as a life, then I can see why there would be a dilemma, because once again, you're sacrificing something that you value for something else that you value, and those two can conflict. With environment, I think it really depends what the question is. I mean, I think here it's pretty clear we're doing the wrong thing environmentally. We need to be paying much more attention to issues of climate change in particular, But, you know, there are dilemmas about, for instance, moving populations or of restricting populations from certain kinds of consumption, perhaps restrictions on how many new people we bring into the world because of our obligations to future generations and so on. So I can see many dilemmas arising in that context, but it's hard to say exactly what they would be in that general area.
Great. Got another call coming in. Hi there. You're on the air. May I have your first name, please?
Hi, I'm David.
David, go ahead.
I have a dilemma that I think about, and it's, you know, the difference between rationality and intuition, is that there's a baby in the middle of the road and a truck bearing on it. I think most people would say that you put yourself at risk to save the baby, but if you look at it rationally, it's easy enough to make another baby, and I've already put, there's already been a lot of effort putting into raising me and educating me and that sort of thing. And so it seems to me that I would be more valuable. I'd like your input on that.
Great. Thanks. Good question.
Sure, David. I think the place where I would disagree with you is where you say it's easy to make another baby, because you can never make that same person. Any one individual person, baby or not, is a unique individual, and they... one can't substitute one person for another person. So that's what, for me, interferes with simply making the calculation about one life being more valuable than another life. Even if you were to decide, indeed, you're not going to risk your own life to save the baby, it's indeed is still a dilemma in the sense that that resolution of the conflict is going to result in an irreplaceable loss of something that really matters, namely this other human life that didn't get saved and that cannot be replaced.
Another call? Hi there, you're on the air. May I have your first name, please? Turn down your radio.
Charlene.
Charlene, go ahead.
Oh, I thought they were still talking. Hi. I just wanted to make a few comments regarding dilemma. And one is, like, when the Titanic was sinking, so many people could only get in the rafts, you know, to be saved, and then there was many, many more people in the water, and it's like, who do you save, and do you take in more, and then should you all go down together, or should you just have a few survive while you watch the others die? And right now, I think one of our dilemmas in the world is with the refugee crisis, you know, in certain countries that, you know, if you take in every refugee, the whole country, the whole town may be dying. And I think it's, to me, it's a dilemma without a, that's an impossible solution, like she's talking about, and very sad solution.
Yep. Thanks, Charlene. Good examples. Let's have Lisa respond.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I agree. Those are great examples. You know, the refugee crisis is an excellent, excellent example of a dilemma. I don't think that we are anywhere close to the point of having taken in enough refugees that they're posing a danger in terms of population to the host country. So I don't think we have reached that dilemma yet, but potentially, yes. I mean, entirely open borders would pose that kind of dilemma of how much we are willing to give up the kind of quality of life or something like that, sharing of resources that we value to share infinitely with other people. We're nowhere near at that point yet. I think we can take in many, many, many more refugees, but potentially dilemmas can arise when you're talking about how far, how much does morality demand of us that we give to others or share with others at our own expense. So that's an excellent example.
It really does highlight, too, I think, and come back to it just for a second, this distinction between reasoned moral judgments and intuitive moral judgments. I think that distinction does provide a way of really kind of understanding how this happens with people, and certainly seems to me to provide some insight into maybe some of the apparent irresolvability of some of the differences that people have about morality.
Yeah, and I think even if you can resolve it in the sense of you decide that one option is better than the other option, that doesn't make it not a dilemma,
yeah,
because even the better option may leave some value sacrificed.
We're getting down to the end of the time here, and I want to give you a minute or two to just kind of sum up. There's an awful lot in the book that we didn't talk about. Again, the book is, my guest is Lisa Tessman. She's author of When Doing the Right Thing is Impossible. So, Lisa, if you just, anything you'd like to say in closing, anything you'd like to leave us with, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, I mean, I want to say I really appreciate the question. I think people called in with a lot of good examples of dilemmas. The tendency, and I understand the tendency, is to present the dilemma and then ask, what should we do about it? You know, how should we act in that situation? And, of course, we ask that question because we do need to act, right? Even to not make a decision is to make a decision. And so it's natural to want to know how to respond to these situations of moral conflicts. But the main point that I want to emphasize is that even if I could give you an answer of, you know, choose this option rather than that option, the answer that I'm giving, if it really is a dilemma, should leave you unsatisfied in the sense that you will still be committing a moral wrongdoing, and it might be one of great magnitude, even if you choose the better of the two alternatives, if the situation is really a dilemma at which very important values are at stake.
Yeah, that provides some insight for me, too. It gives a way into understanding kind of the remainder, this leftover feeling, perhaps, or experience that no matter what choice you make, there's something not quite complete about it. It seems to me, ideally, we would like it to be as cut and dried of as traditional ethical philosophers have said it might be.
Yes. That would make life easier.
It sure would. Professor Tessman, thank you very much for joining us today, and thank you for your work. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, it's been my pleasure.
Mine too.
Bye-bye.